had failed. All that was left was giving up her life for vengeance. The road of wife and mother was not hers to walk. But what if? God forgive her for daring to think it. What if she lived? She was the last of the Banu Laith Bedawi, and she bore the burden of keeping her band from dying out. She would need to marry and bear children for that to happen. The confusing, shameful thoughts fled as Zami assented the doctor's approach. A moment later, she saw his big, white-clad bulk trundling under the rock overhang. "Oh, merciful God, is the holy man spitting pious sayings at you already?" he asked. "The sun is barely up!" "Don't misunderstand me. His laconic little jewels are all inspiring enough the first couple of times you hear them. But after that, they start to sound a bit pompous." Rasheed made a small, unhappy noise in his throat.
"Doctor, please."
He sounded like a bullied boy. The ghoul hunter waved a conciliatory hand, and when he spoke, Zamia heard annoyance and affection dance in his voice.
"Oh, to be sure, Rasheed is most useful to have around. The boy can cross a room in the space of a breath, and God is my witness. I've even seen him kill a cyclop."
A cyclop? Truly? Zamia's desert-bound people knew little of the one-eyed giants of the mountains, but she had heard tales of their legendary strength. She risked a brief, impressed glance at Rasheed. The dervish stood stock still, saying nothing. The doctor went on.
"But you see, Rasheed thinks he is wise beyond his years. I will tell you this, girl. There is no such thing as being wise beyond your years. One can only know as much as one has lived to know, though it is certainly possible to learn a great deal less than this. The boy entered the order at a young age and has had a hard dervish's life. He is more serious than most young men his age. How many of them, after all, learn to split rocks with their fists before they learn to shave? But rock splitter, no, he is a young man, who would do well to remember that fact more often."
50 different feelings filled her. She kept her eyes on the ground and said,
"We should be going."
Seeming to speak to no one in particular, the dervish said quietly,
"I am a young man. But as there is an elder amongst our number, one of us at least ought to act in a proper manner."
Zamia looked up and saw a tiny smile on the dervish's pretty bird-like face. Then he walked away, heading for the mules. Clearly such retorts were rare, for the old man just stood there for a moment blinking in shocked silence, watching the dervish walk away. The ghoul hunter turned to Zamia and let out a laugh that shook his broad shoulders and big gut.
"Ha! One of us ought to. Dignified and proper."
He shouted at Rasheed's back.
"Indeed, boy, indeed! And since it clearly isn't going to be me, it might as well be you."
The doctor waggled his bushy gray eyebrows and gave Zamia a conspiratorial wink.
"He hates it that I call him boy, you know."
"And I hate you calling me girl, doctor."
The old man gave an offended sniff.
"Bah! I'll tell you like I tell him. I call you youngsters as I like. I am, after all, old enough to be your granduncle, my dear."
Zamia felt anger flare inside her as they turned to follow Rasheed.
"Before he died, my granduncle called me protector of the band."
Her mind's eye conjured an image of her gnarled gray granduncle Mahlud, whose age had not diminished his skill at water-finding. The ghouls had killed him, too. Again the memories hit her like a hammer blow to the stomach. Why could she not shut them out? She could not sit here and make herself sick with this mourning every few hours. Vengeance would never come from such weakness. The old man said something, apparently repeating himself. The third time, Zamia actually heard him.
"Are you all right, Zamia?"
She growled, low and long. She shoved weakness to the side.
"I am fine, doctor. Why are we standing here chattering? Were we not about to depart?
The old man sighed a tired sigh and fell quiet. Zarmia looked at him more closely. She had watched as he destroyed three of the foul creatures which had so easily slain the fierce warriors of her band. She knew that he wielded great power. But as she looked at him now, a fat old man sweating heavily, though the sun was hardly up, she saw none of the sorts of signs her father had taught her to watch for in a warrior. Being honest with herself, she knew she would not have been able to slay that massive ghoul had its attention not been focused on the doctor. But why had he seemed so helpless, whistling and looking like he was half ready to die without caring whether he took his enemies with him? Having a ghoul hunter on her side would improve her chances for revenge. She was not fool enough to think she needed no allies. But this old man. And then there was the dervish. The Bedouin were not as coy as villagers about the truths of man and woman. Though Zarmia was protector of the band, the older women had taught her, the same as they had the other girls, of the things she had to look forward to, the things she would feel when she looked at a man, and the things she would do when wed. When she looked at Rashid, though, what she felt was confusion. The dervish was a powerful ally, but a distraction. Her mind spun with contradictions. Over the course of the morning, they made their way along a road of packed dirt that grew broader and smoother the farther they went. The dervish offered her his mule. He meant no insult, she supposed. How could he know that a Bedouin would ride nothing but a pure-blood horse? Walking on a road was compromise enough. Zarmia walked two steps behind her new allies, trying to train her feet to the hard earth of the road, and trying to keep her troubled mind from spinning. The little party walked in silence, and Zarmia found herself almost missing the doctor's inane, griping banter. Better than being alone with the painful pictures in her head. They traveled for hours, the old man and Rashid occasionally exchanging a few words. Zarmia largely ignored them as she dwelled on the knife in her pocket. She would never wield it herself, of course. But in a strange way it had become the most important thing on God's great earth. It was just afternoon when a strong wind shift brought Zarmia out of her grim thoughts. They were coming upon a large mass of men's scents. A few minutes later the road, already the broadest Zarmia had ever seen, passed between two large rocks to join another road, twice as wide. And it was as if they had stepped into a sandstorm of people. Zarmia tried to look everywhere at once, the threatening sense of a dozen different strangers assaulting her. It was all she could do not to take the lion shape.
"What is wrong with you? Did you react this way when the trading caravans met up with the band?"
She was without her father's guidance now, but that was no excuse.
"Focus! You cannot panic at every pack of men that passes."
The three of them were absorbed into a dense but quick-moving line of travelers that snaked its way toward Damsawat. Zarmia could see that the road continued straight ahead for a long stretch, then rose at a sharp angle with a massive shrubby dune. The shrubs more or less covered the dunes now, instead of dotting them, which meant that they were coming close to water. A good deal of it, Zarmia guessed from the increasingly dense web of brown-green.
"The River of Tigers," she thought. "It must be nearby indeed."
A moment later she saw the thick green ribbon of it in the distance. Zarmia knew that outsiders thought the Bedouin dazzled by the smallest stream. The idiots knew nothing of the beautiful brooks and springs that nurtured the great oases of the empty kingdom. But this big river, with its boats and the men fishing it. Zarmia was dazzled, though she did all she could to hide it. Across the river were the farms and orchards that, as her father had taught her, sent their yields year in and year out to the hungry hordes of Damsawat. Olives, dates, wheat, waxy earth apples, small fields for pasture. This was as close as Zarmia had ever come to Damsawat. The Benu Laith Bedouin were... had been, she corrected herself painfully. Fiercely independent, even for Bedouin. Her band had had little contact with townsmen, but even an independent band sometimes needed things from other peoples, tools, fruits and grains, and when wild pasture was hard to find, grazing for their animals. The protector of the band was expected to advise on all aspects of the band's health, and she had accompanied her father several times to trade at the fairs that were sometimes held near here. But this close to Dom Sawat, something was different. There was a life that came from the city, and Zamia could already sense it. They pressed on. The incline of the road was steep enough now, and the sun hot enough, that thick rivulets of sweat were pouring down the doctor's face. Zamia wondered again about doing battle alongside this fat old man.
"For the moment," she reminded herself, "you have little choice. These two are the only allies you have in the world."
It was a disturbing thought, but it soon flew from her mind, for then the road crested the dune, and Dom Sawat, King of Cities, lay before her. Zamia stopped dead in her tracks, and for several long moments could not speak.
"I see why this place is called the Jewel of Abyssin," she thought,
seeing the gleaming domes of turquoise and gold and white that dotted the carpet of buildings.
"I always thought Father's stories were exaggerated, but now I see he did not do the horrible size of this place justice."
It almost made her swoon. The buildings. She did not know how to begin counting them. Flat, peaked, and domed, in stone and tile, a dozen different shades, and rising up as high as mountains. Above it all, near what seemed to be the center of the jumble, if it had a center, rose a huge white dome. Zamia was not much used to buildings and had trouble gauging the dome's size, but she was certain that whatever building it topped must be bigger than some of the trade villages she had seen. It had to be the legendary Crescent Moon Palace, the opulent home and stronghold of the Caliph and his family. Zamia's people knew little of, and cared little for, the supposed ruler of all Abyssin. The Bedouin limited their interactions with city men as much as possible, wary of becoming Bekgem tokens at best, or slaves at worst. Yet even among the Bedouin the magnificence of the palace was known, and the few who had seen Dom Sawat had confirmed that the stories did not exaggerate the splendor of the palace. Even from this distance, Zamia could see that they had spoken truly. Outside the great city walls, they came to two long buildings that stank powerfully of horses. There, the doctor handed the mules over to a stooped man wearing ridiculous city clothes. They then proceeded on foot, making their way through the city's massive gates and into an even denser press of people. Zamia had to remind herself that this was not some feverish dream.
"There is so much stone and brick. The very air is thick with it."
She forced herself to stop staring about like a sun-dazzled child. More astonishing than the buildings were the people. If she had thought there was a great mass of them on the road into the city, she saw 100 times more of them now as she passed through the streets. The densest gatherings of men Zamia had ever seen were the village and pilgrimage sites to the northeast. She'd been shocked when she saw those places, with their 100 roofs and buildings of 2 stories. But this was impossible. A riotous mix of clothing and complexions. It was terrifying. Men's and women's scents bled together with 1,000 others, and countless people darted in and out of her peripheral vision. How could she scent out enemies in a crowd like this?
"There are so many people here,"
she said without meaning to.
"You should have seen it on our way out of here,"
the old man bellowed. He turned to Rasid.
"We'll get home twice as quick, I think."
Zamia had trouble imagining the streets being any more crowded. Veiled Rugali women lined the street, grinding sweet-smelling spice with pestles the size of war clubs. Girls in gym-thread half-robes walked arm-in-arm with soft, wealthy-looking men. 2 boys led small goats along the edge of the crowd. She even saw 2 men wearing the camel-calf suede of Bedouin tribesmen. She avoided their eyes, but they seemed more interested in the city itself than in the odd sight of a young tribeswoman alone in the Jewel of Abyssin. Zamia tried to ignore all of the beast and people sense as best she could. The sights were confusing enough. A hard-faced man jumped in her path. Zamia tensed for a fight, weighing the risks of taking the shape in this unfamiliar place. The man, smelling of deceit, shook a leather cup and screamed about triangle dice. Before Zamia could do anything, the doctor elbowed the man away, spitting something about rigged games of chance. The man bowed mockingly and turned to his next potential player. Again she resisted the urge to turn on her heel and run at lion's speed back into the desert. But she thought of her father, who had been to Dam Sawa'at once in his youth. This gave her strength. If Nader Binu Laith Bedawi had visited this monstrous place and lived to tell the tale, surely his daughter could honor his memory by doing the same. Thoughts of her father and of his fate filled her with increasing resolution. She reminded herself that the path to vengeance, the only thing she lived for now, moved through this sandstorm of a city and its colorful carpet of hundreds of people? Thousands? She did not have words for the number of people who must live in such a place. They continued down the street slowly, the press of the crowd preventing them from moving any faster. Every few moments she looked to her left to make sure the doctor was still there. She'd fought against the fiercest warriors of rival tribes. She'd killed a ghoul. But Zamia found herself as frightened now as she'd ever been in her life. What if she were to get separated from the old man? How would she find her way back to him? Amidst the trackless dunes of the desert, she could follow anyone or anything. But here, with all of these buildings and carts and smells and sounds and people? This city could swallow me whole, and no one would notice. She stepped even closer to Adula Makhlud, and her voice came out as a whisper.
How many people live in Dam Sawa'at?
The old man smiled in a way that made her feel like a fool, though she did not think that was his intention.
My dear,
he began, how many people were in your band?
Around 50 most years.
And how many bands make up your tribe?
Around 100. We have a tribal council once every 3 years.
Her dry eyes stung with recalled tears of frustration as she thought of the last tribal council she'd attended, only 1 year ago. But despite the unjust treatment her band had received at the last council, Zamia swelled with pride, remembering the huge masses at the gatherings of the Binu Laith. She raised her chin as she spoke.
The Binu Laith Bedawi are a great tribe. Our numbers when we gather are fearsome. The gathered tents dot the dunes like...
She trailed off, realizing how ridiculous she was about to sound. The old man cleared his throat, pretending not to notice her embarrassment.
Imagine your whole tribe gathered, then 99 more tribes of the same size, then next to them 100 more tribes of the same size, 200 of your tribal gatherings next to each other and on top of one another. That is how many people are in this city before you.
The pride in his voice was unmistakable. For a moment she thought the old man was lying to her. But why should he? Still, how could so many all live in the same place? How could they breathe? How could they move from place to place without going mad? She asked the doctor these questions, knowing she would sound naive but not quite caring. The old man laughed and said,
Why, my dear, I go a bit more mad every time I step out my front door. That is the true test of a living city. Remind me to tell you about the time it took me 2 full days to get from the Lane of Monkeys to the Far Gardens.
The crowd opened up a bit as the doctor and the dervish led her through a great paved square lined with statues. Zamia was so focused on staying close to the doctor that she took no real notice of the statues until she was right next to one. It was a depiction of one of the angels, she realized. When she looked into its eyes, she froze in her tracks at the beauty she saw. The Binu Laith Bedawi traded vigorously enough that small bits of the city carver's fine stone craftwork sometimes came into tribesmen's hands, inevitably displayed with an untribesmanlike vanity and affectation that had always irritated Zamia. But the work here, on these statues, the way their eyes were full of life. The doctor tugged at her arm.
I know, child. Even after all these years, I am sometimes awestruck by their beauty. But let us move on.
Again he smiled with pride, as if he were a chieftain, and this city his band. They walked a bit more, and the buildings they passed now were clearly the homes of poorer folk. People on the street called out greetings to the doctor, eyeing Zamia curiously but asking no questions. They finally came to a stop before a tall building of whitish stone, with two sad-looking clumps of thorn clover sitting before it in earthen pots. Using a large iron key, the doctor opened the front door. He stood there for a moment, then raised his palms skyward and smiled.
"Thanks be to God that I am here to set foot on my doorstep again," he bellowed.
As soon as they stepped inside, the old man sat down hard on a divan of dark wood and let out the loudest yawn Zamia had ever heard. He offered her a worn cushion that would have been a prized possession among the Binu Laith Bedui, but was clearly not appreciated as such by a city man like the doctor. The dervish disappeared into another room and returned with water in a cool jug and a plate of nuts and dried fruits. He lit a small olive oil lamp, and the mellow smell of it soothed Zamia. The trio nibbled and sipped for a few minutes before the dervish spoke.
"I fear I know already what your response will be, Doctor. But I would suggest that our next move should be to inform the Caliph's men of this threat."
The doctor rolled his eyes.
"If you know my response, boy, then there's no need for me to say that the Caliph's attentions on these matters would be more of a hindrance than a help."
Zamia was sure she wore the same cynical look as the doctor. She made a noise in her throat.
"Even the Bedouin know that the Caliph's men are wicked, Dervish. The dogs of Damsawa'at care little for what has happened to the Binu Laith Bedouin."
"Dogs of Damsawa'at?" the doctor repeated. "What is that? Some savage scorn name for city men? You do realize that I am a dog of Damsawa'at, do you not, girl? Yet you are ready enough to accept my help."
Zamia kept herself from growling at the old man.
"Your help, Doctor? Was it not I that saved you from that foul creature last night?" "She has a point, Doctor,"
the dervish chimed in, apparently giving up on his suggestion regarding the authorities. For only the second time, Zamia saw that hard but pretty, fine-featured face register amusement. Again she thought bitterly that, not long ago, had she met this man, her thoughts might have gone quickly to courtship, to the pride with which her father would have entertained the notion of such a match, and the grudging admiration the band would have had for his battle skill. But now such thoughts were useless. The band's memory, demanded the avenging lioness. The marriage-minded girl dishonored them.
The doctor muttered about disrespectful children and ran a hand over the endless folds of his kaftan. Then he stood and began to pace. "Now, as I said last night, this business with the bloody knife is the purview of the alchemists. My alchemist friends are not home now, but we will call on them at first light. Then I will want you to meet another youngster who has lost kin to these same monsters. The two of you are the only ones to witness this threat, and it will help me to hear you speak again, side by side."
Zamia could not contain her anger.
"More talking? We waste a day, old... Doctor, surely there are others in the city with these skills."
The old man shrugged.
"A handful. But they all charge very dearly indeed, and they aren't the types to take kindly to savage children who come barging into their shops telling them what they must do, as I've no doubt you would do."
Zamia growled. The old man only smiled.
"Besides, not one of them is as good at what they do as Litaz is. Whatever time we lose in waiting, we will more than gain back due to her aptitude. Now do try to settle yourself. We've much to do tomorrow, and as soon as we have a quarry, we will begin the hunt."
The doctor's smile turned hard.
"You think me a lazy old oaf, and when I look at you, I see an impertinent savage of a girl. But in the name of God, our meeting in battle together brings the heavenly chapters to my mind. O believer, look to the accident that is no accident. We were meant by God to fight this bloody cruelty together, Zamia Binu Leith Bedawi, and so we shall.
The glint in the ghoul hunter's eyes gave Zamia the first real hope she'd felt in days. It was a vicious, bitter sort of hope, but it was all she had. Nadu Binu Leith Bedawi's band would be avenged. For an hour or so, Zamia lay half-dozing on a divan just inside the front door. It felt good, despite the dark thoughts that crept in at the edge of her ease. Then the doctor announced that it was time to eat. Zamia did not understand city people. A shriveled old woman who lived next door to the doctor brought over plates of food. Though she looked nothing like him, Zamia assumed that she was his sister or his mother. Why else would she live so close, and why would she feed him thus? But the woman did not stay to eat with them, and the doctor gave her a coin before she left. It was as rude and shameless as anything Zamia had seen. But then she had heard that city men paid coins for love-making as well. The doctor loaded his plate with thick slices of meat stuffed with a rich green dressing.
Pale wine and pistachio lamb, thanks to all providing God that not everything he sends my way is a maddening trial.
The old man filled his cup, guzzled it down, refilled it.
Eat, girl!
He bellowed, bits of pistachio flying from his mouth as he gestured to the plates before him.
We'll be on the move again soon enough, I fear. You'll wish then that you had eaten.
He took another long gulp of pale wine. Zamia tried to tell herself that she was not hungry, that she had no room in her for anything but revenge, though she knew it for a lie. The smell set her stomach growling, as if the hungry, thirsty lioness within her were speaking up. With no further prompting from the doctor, she sloshed back half her wine and began to stuff herself with mouthfuls of lamb. After a few bites, though, her stomach began to clench.
"The city food is too rich," she said,
then drained her cup with a second and third gulp. The dervish smiled a mesmerizing smile.
"I couldn't agree more, Zamia Binu Leith Bedawi. You will notice that I am eating only fruit and bread and beans. The diet of the pious."
She found herself speaking.
"You may call me simply Zamia Rasid."
Where did that come from? This cursed wine is too strong. The dervish mumbled something embarrassed-sounding and locked his eyes on his plate.
"He is older than me, yet he seems so young."
"Well,"
the old man bellowed, tipsily breaking the tension.
"Such bird food is suitable enough, perhaps, for little holy men's mouths. But not for a man of my..."
He paused, hefting up his big belly with both hands.
"A man of my significance."
The ghoul hunter turned to Zamia, a note of solicitude entering his voice.
"I have spent long decades as a servant of God, you know. I've traveled roads this presumptuous boy has never even heard of. 40 years worth of days at war with a traitorous angel. Is it so wrong that I should wish to spend my nights like this?"
The old man took another big swallow of wine and turned back to Rasid with a troublemaker's smile.
"You're as bad sometimes as those humble students you respect so much. Perhaps you should join their stupid little sect, scandalized by ale and dancing and such."
He poked a reproving finger at Rasid.
"Remember what the chapters say. God speaks through these chapters, not through the mouths of priests. His scriptures are not written upon papyrus, parchment, or vellum. They are marked in men's memories, stamped on men's hearts, engraved in men's souls. Yet your order and the humble students act as if the chapters were written on their lips."
He took another drink.
"Before their glory faded from Abyssinia, the ghoul hunters' ways were unbending in some things. But at least they never claim to be holy men. God is the most beneficent host, boy. When you've forgotten that, you've forgotten why we fight."
His tirade over, the ghoul hunter threw his hands up in exaggerated exasperation. For a while, there were only the sounds of eating and the old man's heavy breath. When the meal was done, they sat there silently. Then the doctor's too loud voice shattered the silence.
"Speaking of fighting," he said, as if 10 minutes had not passed, "I have been wondering something, Zarmia. If, God willing, we find this damned by God servant of the traitorous angel, and we defeat him, what will you do then?"
Zarmia felt the pleasant haze of the wine burn away in an instant.
Why does he bring this up now?
It sounded to her as if the ghoul hunter already knew what her answer would be, and disapproved of it.
"All that matters is that I kill whoever or whatever has done this. Likely I will die doing so. That is as it should be. Martyrdom for me. Vengeance for my band."
The whiny cheer was gone from his voice.
"Martyrdom. Are you so eager to die, Zarmia?"
She came to her feet and hissed at the old man.
"Why should I wish to live? Everyone I know is dead. My band is dead. I can only pray that my fate is to avenge them before I die myself."
The doctor stared at her, and his gaze was hard.
"Remember that even fate has its forking roads. Your father saw the touch of the angels upon you and chose you to be protector of the band, though you are female. He understood the chapter that reads, 'Only so many fates for each man, but always a choice.'"
The doctor poked idly at the single bean on his plate, the only bit of food that remained there.
"But enough grim talk for now. We must see to what we city folk call your sleeping arrangements, and what the better we call some random patch of sandy dirt. Oh, I am sorry, girl, I only jest. But of course we would not shame you by having you sleep in the house of a man, not your husband or father. I don't doubt my neighbor, the old woman who brought our dinner, will set a pallet for you. For a young woman such as—"
Zarmia growled.
"I am not a girl, doctor. My father did choose me for protector of the band, and that is what I am. The protector sleeps where he must. If you would be so kind to set a pallet here at the foot of the stairs, that will be fine."
Beside her, the dervish made a strangled noise. Zarmia ignored him, because she could not afford to lose control of herself.
"What I want to know," she asked, "is whether we are truly safe here, doctor. I do not wish to wake to the feeling of my ribcage being cracked open. The one whose ghoul pack we fought, what is to stop him from striking us here?"
The doctor yawned and smiled patronizingly.
"Sneaking ghouls about within a city is no easy matter, child, and besides, my home is charmed so that no ghoul can cross its threshold."
The old man shoved his dirty plate rudely in Rasid's direction and got up from the table. His lazy expression grew urgent again.
"Listen to me. One of the Benulaith Bedawi still lives. When she dies, then your band is dead. Until that day, girl, your band lives."
He waggled a big finger at her and left the room. She turned to where the dervish had sat, afraid but excited to be alone with him. But when she turned, the little man was gone. Something inside her twisted and untwisted in disappointment and relief. A little while later, a great storm of things flew through Zamia's mind as she lay on her pallet seeking sleep. The sight of her brother with his heart torn out and his eyes shining red. Her father's hand clutching a dagger. The sound of ghouls hissing. The smells of this strange city. Rasid's brief smiles. And the doctor's admonitions. "Your band lives," he had said. She had already counted herself half dead, she realized. She'd been acting as if the band of Nader Binulaith Bedawi were gone from God's great earth forever. The ghoul hunter, with his city man's love of this one building he called home, did not understand her people. He did not understand what she had lost. But he had started her thinking nonetheless. Home, Zarmia thought. For the nomadic Bedawi, it was not a place. The strains of one of her people's most important songs forced its way into her head. It would start with the boys singing, "Home is where my father is. I am a true Bedouin." Then the men would take their turn singing, "Home is where my sons are. I am a true Bedouin." Then all would sing together, "Home is where my band's tents are. I am a true Bedouin." The song was a boastful one, intended to flaunt her people's superiority to the soft villagers and city folk. But now it took on a mournful irony. Her father had joined her mother in death. She had no sons or daughters. The isolation of her band meant that no other band would take her in. How could she ever know a home again? The burning need for revenge had pushed her far, but her body felt as if it would melt from exhaustion. There was nothing more she could do tonight. Nothing, that is, but mourn all she had lost. And so, sure that she was out of the hearing range of her newfound allies, and more tired than she'd ever been, Zamia Benulaith Bedouin, for the first time in years, very quietly cried herself to sleep. Part 2. The guardsman did not know how many days he had been held in the red lacquered box. The lid opened, and the gaunt man's hard hands pulled him, naked and whimpering, from the box. The gaunt man threw him to the dirt floor. The guardsman lay there, his throat burning with thirst, trying to remember his name. All he could remember was that he was a guardsman, born in the Crescent Moon Palace and sworn to service there, that the other guardsmen served under him. The gaunt man and his shadow creature would not let him forget that. And he remembered the street thief and the beggar. The gaunt man had killed them both slowly, letting their blood spatter onto his already filthy caftan. He had made the guardsmen listen to their pleas, made him smell their waste as they soiled themselves in fear. He did not know where he was now. A room, rafters and scrabbling rats. A cellar? A cell? Then he heard the squealing in his mind, and the jackal thing's voice was in his head again.
"Listen to Mawawa, once called Hedunawas, who speaketh for his blessed friend. Thou art an honored guardsman, begat and born in the Crescent Moon Palace. Thou art sworn in the name of God to defend it. All of those beneath thee shall serve. Listen to Mawawa, who is unseen and unheard by men until he doth strike, who doth laugh away sword blade and arrow, who was remade by the jackal god and freed from his prison by his blessed friend. Listen to Mawawa and know no hope. Know that none shall save thee. Mawawa doth use his powers to sneak and smuggle and kill his blessed friend's enemies. The fat one, the clean one, the kitten."
The shadow jackal man continued to whisper in the guardsman's mind, of blood and bursting lungs. Again he felt hard hands under his armpits. The gaunt man dragged him to the other side of the dark room, where a great black kettle bubbled and hissed and smelled of brimstone, though there was no flame beneath it. The liquid within the kettle looked like molten rubies, and the red glow of it lit the gaunt man's black-bearded face. He felt himself being lifted and plunged into the kettle. He felt his skin being scalded, and somewhere he heard the shameful screaming and pleading of a man who had once been strong. Chapter 7. Zamia Benulaith Bedouin breathed in the scent of her family's death again. She bolted awake, screaming and growling and reliving that horrible night when she'd found her band.
"No. It was just a dream. This is a new night."
She was not in the desert. She was lying on a pallet in Dr. Adula Maxlud's townhouse. But that cruel crypt scent was still there.
Not just a dream.
Out of the corner of her eye, Zomia saw motion. Something lunged at her. Only her angel-touched reflexes and the years of training with her father saved her. Something. Something almost man-shaped. Smashed into the pallet where she had lain a breath space ago.
No! Mauawa, the man-jackal, is unseen and unheard by men until he doth strike. But the kitten hath scented him.
The thing before her was shadow black, save for glowing red eyes. Somehow she heard its words with both her ears and her mind. The creature held a vague shape, something like a jackal walking about on a man's two legs, but the edges of its outline whipped and wavered like tent flags in the wind. The reek of her band's death wafted from the creature, the smell of burnt jackal hair and of ancient child blood. Its eyes, they were a brighter version of what she had seen in her dead bandsman. And looking at the abomination before her, Zanmia knew that it was this thing that had eaten the souls of her band, of her father. She screamed in fear. The thing lunged at her again, and she barely managed to dodge back from its shadow-wrapped fangs. She shouted,
"Proceed, Doctor! Enemies!"
It came out lioness loud, louder than any girl's shout could be, as she took the shape. When she was younger, she had needed to try, over and over again sometimes, to take the shape. But now it came without thinking, in the space of a breath. One moment she was a woman, the next a great golden lioness. One moment a girl's fear filled her, the next her veins raced with sunlight. With the claws and fangs and gold coat came confidence. She dodged another lunge and growled at the creature.
"Whatever you are, you have murdered the Binulith Binui! I'll tear out your throat!"
The thing before her made a sickening whine between a dog's and a vile man's.
"Mauwa is alone no more! He hath been found by his blessed friend, and he shall slay the kitten, and the fat one, and the clean one for his blessed friend. Mauawa doth shiver, knowing how salty sweet will be the kitten's soul of two tastes."
Hearing this thing's voice in her head was disturbing. But her father had taught her years ago to pay attention to an enemy's body rather than their words. Zomia roared again to rouse her allies. Then she leapt at the foul creature before her. Even as she did so, she tried to understand what this monster was. Could her claws cut a shadow? Zomia raked out a left paw and found her answer. The foul thing, Mauawa, it had called itself, spit and whined and danced back in pain.
The kitten has cut Mauawa! Savage as her father, the cruel cutter of Mauawa's blessed friend!
The sheer speed of the creature as it leapt at her caught Zomia off guard. She managed to stay a half-step ahead of one snap of its maw, then another. But she was tiring already, and all signs were that this creature was not. And she was not used to fighting in these cramped conditions. She scrabbled back and tipped over a small bookstand, which pinned her rear paws. God help me! The creature closed and its scent threatened to overwhelm her. A streak of blue flew at the thing that called itself Mauawa.
Proceed!
The dervish's sword was out, and he slashed at the creature, drawing its attention away from Zomia. Once, twice and thrice Rasid's forked sword cleaved into the thing, but it made no mark.
Be careful! This thing, it has the stink of my father's wounds!
Zomia growled. Then she flexed her back legs and shattered the wooden bookstand. Splinters bit into her flesh, but she ignored them. She watched monster and dervish looking for an opening. Again Rasid's sword slashed into Mauawa, but the thing just whined and sneered. Mauawa's fangs missed their mark once, then twice, The creature lashed a forearm across the dervish's chest. Rashid went flying as if he'd been kicked by a horse. Zamiya's heart sank into her stomach. Out of the corner of her eye, Zamiya saw the old man appear on the stairs, shouting. She ignored the doctor, though, and flew at Mawawa.
Neither sword blade nor prayer doth stop Mawawa. He hath smuggled in the spell makings. He shall savor the twin tastes of lion and child, while his blessed friend's creatures slay the clean one and the fat one.
The creature dodged her strike and threw something at the ground. There was a sound like wind whipping, and suddenly two man-sized sandstorms were boiling in the middle of the room. Then the small storms took shape. Arms. Legs. Fangs. Merciful God, if the desert dunes were made monsters, they would look like this. The man-shaped things snapped their jaws, showing teeth like jagged rocks. One darted out a forked tongue. No, not a tongue. A pink rock viper. The desert's deadliest snake. Zamiya saw these creatures come between her and her allies. And that was all of the attention she could spare. The mad, murdering monster before her had earned death, and her only purpose on God's great earth was to kill it. She slashed out again and again, but Mawawa always seemed to step ahead of her blows. That shadow-wreathed snout seemed to sneer.
The kitten does hiss and spit, but she shall die in the mangling maw of Mawawa. Once called Hedda Nawaz.
The other combatants were to her back now. Behind her she heard shouted scripture, Rasid's cries, and magical sounds like small thundercracks. It took all of her discipline not to turn from her foe. Something was on fire, and the smoke, along with the creature's cruel scent, made her gag. She growled loudly. Her band's enemies had fled like children from that growl. But Mawawa just pressed the attack again, coming close enough that Zamiya could feel a strange heat coming from its maw. The creature lunged again and missed. She saw her chance. She sprang, seizing the opportunity the overconfident monster had given her.
Given me!
Too late, Zamiya realized that it was she who was overconfident. Mawawa was not off balance. The thing had feigned and drawn her in. Her claws raked out and dug deep into shadow flesh. But the creature shifted position, and its black jaws snapped, digging into her ribs. Zamiya screamed and hissed and clawed at the thing again. Mawawa stumbled away from her, grievously wounded. But its fangs had done their damage. Now she was aware of nothing but her pain. The pain and a burning red heat that made her whimper. Then there was only darkness.
Merciful God, help me!
Only half believing what he saw, Adula watched two sand ghouls come to false life in his library. Zamiya was locked in battle with a creature like the shadow of a jackal come to life, the likes of which he'd never seen. Rashid was struggling to his feet. Adula noticed these things, but the sand ghouls were what held his attention. The power involved in raising such creatures from a distance, in commanding them from some unseen place, in subverting the ward spells Adula had worked here, was incalculable. The number of men that would have had to be murdered and maimed to work these magics. They faced a dire threat indeed. One of the ghouls charged Adula, a snarl etched on its grotesque, almost human features. Adula's hands were already in the pockets of his caftan. He drew forth a small vial and uncorked it with his thumb. The sand ghoul's raking claws were now only inches from Adula's eyes. But he stood his ground calmly, sprinkling crushed ruby in the air before him, and reciting,
God is the oasis in the desert of the soul!
The ruby dust turned to ash in midair. The ghoul collapsed into a pile of loose sand and dead beetles. Adula felt grains of sand and less pleasant things blow across his face as the creature was drained of its animating magic. In a sort of reflection, he felt the drain of the invocation hit him hard. His chest tightened, and a stitch stung his side. After their battle the night before, he didn't have much left in him. Too old, he thought. But even as he thought it, he saw the lion girl fighting desperately against that shadow thing, and watched Rasid trying hopelessly to slay a sand ghoul with his sword.
No, not too old, he told himself. These children will die if I am.
He summoned strength from God alone knew where, and fumbled in his satchel for some remedy against these creatures. He thanked beneficent God aloud when his fingers closed around three smooth stones the size of grapes. He gathered the lightning beads, each a swirl of mother-of-pearl, and looked up to see that Rasid had been knocked to the ground again. He was already getting to his feet, but the ghoul he'd been battling now darted toward Adula. Adula twisted as the thing hissed and swung at him. He somehow managed not to be torn open by those rock-like claws, but the flat of the ghoul's great forearm caught him across the chest like an iron bar. He fell backward, landing on his ass with a grunt, the wind knocked out of him. He started to throw the beads, then hesitated. They'd cause a fire, no doubt. His home. But he had no choice. Adula threw. The sand ghoul hissed loudly as the tiny stone struck it. They were sucked immediately into the thing's abdomen, sand shifting away from sand to briefly reveal a writhing mass of scorpions and shiny black beetles. Adula spoke the invocation.
God is the lightning that strikes thrice!
It was slurred with pain and regret, but it was enough. There was a loud but muffled noise, like a peal of thunder wrapped in a wool blanket, and the sand ghoul froze in its tracks. Then another muffled peal, and another as the beads exploded inside the creature. Sheets of lightning fire shot out from the sand ghoul's midsection, scalding the arm Adula threw up to protect his face. Small fires caught in the room and spread with magical speed. Adula could smell paper burning, and wondered in agony what books and scrolls he was losing. He saw his furniture catch fire, the very walls of his home aflame. Then the invocation's drain hit him, and he collapsed, pain and smoke filling his mind. Rasid watched one of the sand ghouls crumble from the doctor's invocation, and thanked God as he faced off against the second one. He had never fought sand ghouls before, though the doctor had spoken of them. It was not like fighting bone ghouls or water ghouls. No matter how many times Rasid swung his sword, the blade found no flesh to bite. Every thrust slid into loose sand, and it took every bit of Rasid's skill just to dodge the ghoul's blows as he freed his sword.
Almighty God, what can I do against such a monster?
But his thoughts were dashed out of him as the creature slammed him to the ground with a great grainy fist. He came to his feet quickly, and saw the doctor toss something at the ghoul, and speak an invocation before passing out. There was a thundercrack sound, and Rasid threw up an arm to shield himself from a sheet of fire. He turned his face from the blast, and saw Zamia fighting that shadow creature. Rasid's skin and silks were singed, but he ignored the pain. When he turned back to the sand ghoul, he saw that the doctor's invocation had had a remarkable effect. At the sounds of the small explosions, the creature had stopped moving, incapacitated by whatever passed for pain in such a monster. The magical heat of the explosions had caused the palm tree thick midsection of the sand ghoul to melt into glass. The melted remains of scorpions and centipedes clouded the glass with black. The sand ghoul was stopped in its tracks. Small fires burned about the room, catching and spreading with astonishing speed. But Rasid focused on his enemy. He knew an opportunity when he saw one. Glass could be broken. He sheathed his sword, extended his right arm, and pointed his fist at the sand ghoul. With a loud shout that focused his soul, he flew forward, thrusting his fist into the thing's stomach. If it has a stomach... There was an ear-splitting crack. Then a thick tinkling sound like a thousand tiny bells. Rasid felt countless splinters of hot glass digging into his skin, from his knuckles all the way up his arm to his elbow. But he was focused, and not a glimmer of pain made it through his training. Praise God. In a blur of movement, he withdrew his arm from the monster's midsection. The sand ghoul collapsed in a rain of sand, broken glass, and dead centipedes. Rasid turned from the waist-high pile before him, scanning the room. The whole house was filling with smoke and fast-spreading fire. The townhouse walls were blackening with flame. The doctor lay moaning in pain, but did not seem to be badly wounded. A golden lion, Zamia, squatted in the corner, growling and whimpering as she bled. Rasid's breath caught in his throat. The jackal creature, clearly wounded, struggled to stand and make its way to the window. It whined as shadow stuff whirled about it in tattery flags. Rasid heard it speak somehow in his mind, even as he moved toward it.
No! Mawawa hath been cut and bitten! Might this mean his death? No, his blessed friend shall heal him. His blessed friend shall sit on the cobra throne, while Mawawa's howls doth hound the air!
The thing clawed at the lattice window, splintering the dark wood and howling in pain. Before Rasid could reach it, it leapt from the second-story window to the hard-packed dirt road below. The fall will kill it, Rasid half-hoped. But as the thing hit the ground, it seemed to simply melt away. He himself had a remarkable skill in stealth, but this was different. Mawawa did not hide. It joined with the lamp shadows. The thing had fled, but it was not dead. Rasid could sense that much. It was Rasid's duty to pursue, but his eyes were drawn to the limp forms of Zamia and the doctor. They needed him now. The tribeswoman had changed shape again in the space of a moment. He felt his heart would burst, seeing this girl of 5 and 10 years with a grisly wound in her side. The doctor moaned and sat up, coughing from the smoke around them. The flames blazed hotter, the wood of divan and bookshelf cracking and popping in the fires. Zamia whimpered. Only her mouth moved, making pained, pleading sounds. His gaze returned to the street below.
Oh God, is it wicked to let such a monster flee just to save the lives of friends?
But even as his soul asked Almighty God for guidance, his body choked from smoke and moved to Zamia's side. Suddenly a glowing green light filled the townhouse. As he reached Zamia, he saw 100 tiny hands the color of seawater stamping at the flames and waving away smoke. Magic, but not the sort of spell the doctor worked. Whatever it signified, Rasid didn't care. All that mattered was Zamia's wound, which was bubbling and hissing horribly, as if with an alchemist's acids. Rasid felt tears filling his eyes, and not only from the smoke. He felt the doctor's large hand on his shoulder and heard that gruff voice in his ear.
Come, boy! Help has arrived!
Rasid snarled at his mentor.
We should not have brought her here, doctor! She's just a child!
An incoherent cry escaped from his throat.
We should not have brought her!
He was startled by the sudden impulse to strike the doctor. The doctor winced from the smoke and the pain of his wounds.
Snap out of it, boy! I said there is help here!
Rasid saw, more than felt, a bony, red-black hand on his forearm. Daoud, Litas, the doctor's friends. The smoke filled his eyes and his mind. He let himself be guided out of the burning townhouse, only half aware of what was happening. The next thing he knew, he was standing in front of his ruined, soot-blackened home. The spell fires were already dying, but they had done their damage. The doctor sat on the street, his head in his hands. His Sioux friends, the tall, bald Magus Daoud, and his wiry little wife, Litas, stood beside him, gently setting Zamia's unmoving body onto a litter.
The fire's been dealt with,
Daoud was saying to the dazed-looking doctor.
We got to it before it could spread to the neighbors. My magics keep them from seeing or smelling what has happened here. But what in the name of God has happened here, Ardula? And who is she?
The doctor stuttered, obviously trying to regain his wits. Rasid heard himself doing the same thing.
Questions for later,
he heard Litas's voice say from somewhere.
Whoever she is, she's dying here. We have to get her to our home. Now! Rasid!
He realized he'd been staring uselessly at Zamia's unmoving form, her soot-stained face, and her closed, long-lashed eyes. Again he tried to speak, but his throat burned from smoke and tears. Ash caked his silks.
Auntie!
he finally managed. The little Sioux alchemist's voice was sharp, and her blue-black features were stern.
"We've brought Elita," she said,
the rings in her twist-locked hair clicking as she nodded toward the wood and leather frame.
"Help me carry it."
His hands and feet moving without his seeming to will it, Rasid obeyed her command. As they lifted the litter, Zamia shrieked once in pain. Rasid felt as if the sound were tearing out his insides. Zamia grimaced and then fell silent.
"There's hope here yet," Litaz said. "Move, boy!"
Rasid blinked away more tears, and he moved. Chapter 8. In the hour or so that was neither night nor morning, the scholars' quarter of the great city of Damsawat was quiet. The most indefatigable of the street people had finally gone to bed, even if bed was merely a bit of dirt lane. The first of the cart drivers, porters, and shopkeepers would not hit the street for another hour or so. Litaz, daughter of Likami, stared out her cedar-framed window, rubbing her temples and thanking merciful God for small blessings. The soothing quiet had made the first part of her work a bit easier. The busy, rough scholars' quarter was usually so noisy that its name, a vestige of the city's long past, Adula had told her, seemed an intentional irony. But Litaz prided herself that she, her husband, and their old friend Adula kept the bookish appellation from becoming a total lie. Ages after the neighborhood's sages and students had been replaced by cheap shopmen and pimps, the three of them ensured that learning still lived in the quarter, that their learning pertained to unnatural wounds and creatures made of grave beetles made no difference. Litaz turned from the window and considered the half-dead girl lying on the low couch before her, her coarse hair splayed across the cushions. The tribeswoman's labored breathing was the loudest sound in the room, a sharp contrast to a few hours ago, when they'd come charging in with a dying, angel-touched girl on a litter. The wound was like none Litaz had ever seen. The tribeswoman had been bitten, though not so badly as to be life-threatening. But within the wound, it was as if the girl's soul had been poisoned rather than her body. It didn't fit any of Litaz's formulae. Praise God that Daoud, as he had in so many of their past healings, had intuited what to do. Her own tonics and wound poultices had stabilized the girl's health. But it had been Dawood's powers, his mastery of the weird green glow that rose from within him as his hand snaked back and forth above the girl's heart, that had truly brought her from the brink of death. The smell of brewing cardamom tea brought her out of her thoughts. She could hear Dawood in the next room, clinking cup against saucer for her. Making each other's tea was half the reason they had such a happy marriage. It was one of the most important lessons of alchemy, one that had stuck with her from the first days, when she'd left behind the stifling lifestyle of a lady of the Sioux court to pursue her training. Simple things ought not be taken for granted. She'd seen a horned monster from another world kill a man because of a small error in a summoning circle. She'd seen a husband and a wife grow to hate each other because they'd forgotten each other's naming days. A shout came in the window from the street, a late drunk or an early cartman. As if in response, the Bedouin girl, Zamia, Adula had called her, made a pained noise. Litaz said a silent prayer for the girl and worried over the limits of her own healing craft. She pulled a clay jar from one of the low visiting room shelves and scooped a handful of golden yam candies from it. The sweet, earthy flavor filled her mouth and calmed her. They were expensive, these tiny reminders of home, but there was nothing quite like them.
"You deserve the old jar of them, hard as you have worked these past few hours. I think the girl will live because of it."
Her husband came into the room bearing a tea tray in his bony, careworn hands. Concern for her was etched on his wizened red-black face.
"Where are Adula and Rasid?"
she asked. He jutted his hennaed goatee at the stairway.
"Both upstairs.
The boy is in some kind of self-recriminating meditation. Adula is mourning his home and racking his brain regarding this attack.
Litas had been doing the same since Adula had hurriedly explained that the girl was angel-touched, and described the creature that had attacked her.
"It would not be madness enough,"
some sliced-off, calloused part of her thought,
"for our Adula to bring us a dying Bedouin girl. She should have to be a shape-changer, too."
As though seized by her old friend's soul, Litas snorted out a bitter laugh. She took a teacup from Daoud and sipped as she sat by the girl's side. The tribeswoman wore a pained grimace as she slept. Again, Litas found herself troubled by the strangeness of the girl's malignant wound. For decades, she had traveled with her husband and their various companions, dealing with creatures and spells that most men thought unfathomable. But Litas knew that everything in this world could be analyzed. The ghouls, the jinn, balls of fire and bridges made from moon rays. All of it made sense if one understood the formulae. She had given up years ago on searching for liqueurs of agelessness and turning copper into gold that stays gold. Nor did she waste her talents on the stupid duties that employed the city's handful of other master alchemists. Working for weeks at a time to separate alloys or encourage crops and make rich men richer was not a way to spend a life, no matter the wealth such work might bring. But helping hurt people was different. Looking at the girl's wound again, Litas once more set to work as an assessor of things. She had only ever read about soul killing. It was new to her, though she knew it was an ancient magic. What mattered here, though, was that it had nearly killed a girl in the home of her and her husband's closest friend. That made it their problem, too. She set down her teacup and put a hand to the carved wooden clip that held up her long twist locks. Daoud, her opposite in so many ways, had often teased her that it was a fussy Eastern Sioux hairstyle. Years ago he'd proposed that she shave her head, like one of his red-black countrywomen from the Western Republic. The thought still horrified her. Her husband stepped wordlessly to her side and put his hand on her back. She felt the pressure of his long, strong fingers and thanked God, not for the first time, that someone so unlike her could be such an inseparable part of her. Litas heard a noise on the stairs and turned to see Adula wearily making his way down them. Dawood's hand left her back, and he went over to embrace their friend. She didn't really see the pain in Adula's heavy-lidded eyes until she heard him speak in a voice not his own, the small voice of a weak man.
"My home. Daoud, my home, it...
He trailed off, his eyes shining with tears, and his big, broad shoulders slumped. It troubled her to see Adula this way. He was not easily shaken. Her husband stepped back from embracing his friend, and shook the ghoul hunter by his shoulders.
"Listen to me! Look at me, Adula! God is the most merciful, do you hear me? It will take money to repair and time, but 6 months from now you'll be back where you started, minus a few old books and scrolls."
Adula swallowed and shook his head.